Listen to shoot the defence. It's unbelievable, Jeff.
Hello and welcome to show number two of the Shoot the Defence World Cup special. I'm your host, Stel, and joining me this evening is none other than a good friend of the show, a good friend of mine, and a guy who I've been bantering with all day regarding Lionel Messi, which we're going to go into a bit later on. It's co-host or joint host of the Low Limit Football podcast. It is Mr. Roberto Rojas. ¿Cómo estás, my friend? What's going on?
What's up, Steph? How you doing? It's pretty hot over here in the States, I take it here. And I take it over there in England, it's a bit cold, or at least some sort of average weather that you're finally getting?
It's what we call chilly tonight. It's a little bit chilly, you know? Uh-huh. But, yeah, we've had good weather today. We've had good weather the past couple of weeks. Since the World Cup has started a few days ago, it's almost as if the British weather has felt our joy, our happiness, and said, right, we're going to give you some sun. And we've had that, which is good, because everyone seems to be a lot happier when the sun's out in the UK. When it's miserable and raining and whatnot, it kind of, people's attitudes reflects the weather. So as you can tell, Britain is usually a miserable place. So yeah, but it's all good, man. It's great to have you on. It's been a while since you've been on the show, so it's great to catch
up. Yeah, it has. I mean, hey, you were great over that time that we had you on my show, on me and Joe's show, I think the day after the Champions League final.
Thank you very much. I was half expecting you guys to get pulled off the network when I came on after some of my comments, but
no, we managed. We try to convince them not to pull us out or anything.
That's all right. I'll watch my language next time. I promise. Right, I tell you what, let's talk about these games, shall we? And we didn't do a show yesterday because we thought, well, we're going to do seven games tonight. First game we'll discuss is the first game that was shown yesterday, and that was Egypt 0, Uruguay 1. And Uruguay left it late to beat a very, very well-drilled Egypt by a goal to nil. And Luis Suarez and Edinson Cavani were kept at bay by Mohamed El Shenawy in the Egypt goal. But he could do absolutely nothing about Jose Jimenez's header in the 89th minute. Now, Robbie, credit has to go to both teams, mate, really. I mean, Egypt stuck to their game plan. They put up a fight without the talisman Salah. And Uruguay were persistent. They just didn't give up. What did you make of the game?
Yeah, I thought it was a really good game between both the teams. I think when you're looking at Egypt more, you know, they kind of frustrated them, you know, with a more defensive line, you know, trying to stay compact. You know, obviously without Mohamed Salah, you kind of lose a bit of that importance and especially, you know, I guess, great player that he is. You know, it kind of frustrated Egypt as well. And, you know, I think many people perceived it as a, you know, perhaps from a Uruguayan perspective, as overconfidence that, you know, with the team that they had, certainly even without Salah and with Salah, they would win. But, you know, you kind of looked at Uruguay as a team, you know, it was frustrating to watch them at times because you saw that they were going onto goal. You know, you saw them, you know, just going with various opportunities, evening, you know, just going on the counter. You know, obviously not a really bad performance, I think, from Suarez. I think he missed about, what, 3-4 opportunities onto goal. Mm. But certainly not a good day for the strikers, but definitely a great day for the defenders, that's for sure. And, of course, the goalkeeper, El Shenawy. I think, you know, Godin was very compact, very just a great figure over there in the back. And, obviously, the goal from Jimenez in the 85th minute really just, you know, gave confidence for Uruguay. And I think gave confidence now and to really head into their next game against Saudi Arabia, which I think, you know, with all due respect to the Fares game that we saw, it should be an easy formality for Uruguay. But really, you know, it puts Egypt now into this big, big scenario against the host in the next game to really be obligated to win or, you know, face elimination.
Mm, that's right. And the thing is, when you look at how the game could have panned out with Salah and the team, do you think Cooper would have stuck with the 4-5-1 when his team didn't have the ball? Because I noticed that whenever Uruguay had possession of the ball, especially in the Egypt half, there was a bank of five in front of the four defenders there, and they made it very narrow for Uruguay. You saw the likes of Varela on the right-hand side, the right-back, the former United right-back, you know, trying to get forward as much as he possibly could to support the front men with balls in the box. But it just wasn't happening for him. And, you know, if Salah is there, do you think Egypt would play such a conservative style?
I would think so. You know, obviously, you get more of that importance from Egypt having such an influential player like Salah. It was going to be difficult to really break down this really strong Uruguayan side. You know, even in the midfield, even on the tag, and especially on the defense, it was kind of inconsistent on all ends, especially on the attack. I mean, you saw the opportunities that they had. And I think with Salah, you kind of had, I think for Egypt, they would have had much more opportunities, especially on the counter and, you know, trying to break away with speed of breaking through those defenders. I think that would have gave Egypt a more advantage heading into this game. But it's tough to say. I mean, obviously, you know, the game really could have gone to Uruguay much more had it not been for the missed chances by Cavani and Suarez. I think in the end, I think it was more of a good game by the Uruguayans, and, you know, credit to Egypt as well to try to hold them on to the 89th minute. Very, very unlucky to do so. And, you know, I think it was really an entertaining game overall.
Absolutely, mate. And, you know, you mentioned Luis Suarez. It was a very rare off day for him, wasn't it? He had the shot off target early on. He scuffed a shot wide. He was actually unmarked with only 6 yards out. And the goalkeeper denied him twice. And then, you know, you got the opportunities from Cavani. There was the free kick that hit the post. There was that outstanding volley, which the goalkeeper had no right to save, which he did. And for me, I remember coming on your show some time back, and we were talking about the top five greatest strikers in the world at the moment. I didn't put Cavani in my top five because I had five other players who I felt were better, but from a personal standpoint, because I've got Cavani in my dream team, I kind of wanted him to get a couple of goals. But not just for that, I think he's been kind of shunned a little bit at Paris Saint-Germain. You know, Ibrahimovic was the main man a couple of seasons ago. Neymar obviously came in and took that mantle, and here you've got a striker that has scored goals wherever he's been. So I'm really hoping, not just for my dream team points, but I'm hoping for Cavani's sake, that he kind of takes the spotlight away from Luis Suarez.
Yeah, absolutely. And you kind of see that. I mean, obviously, you know, I was looking at a stat the other day that, you know, every time that Cavani has scored, you know, it usually ends into a Uruguay loss. You know, they haven't won when he does score. So, I mean, you kind of hope that he does such a thing because, you know, he is such a talented player, maybe to the case of underrated for some people, you know, as bad as, you know, that seems. A lot of people really are really just underestimating the talent that Cavani has, and you saw that over the season at PSG. I just think at Uruguay, it's so different to fight for the spotlight when you're dealing with Suarez both going up front. It's so difficult. But in the end, I think, you know, you want to get the best out of them, and I feel that you will heading into this next game against Saudi Arabia. I'm absolutely certain that one of these two players will definitely score and really, you know, try to get their World Cup back on form to hopefully help Uruguay. Because, you know, in the end, it is a World Cup. Obviously, every result is important. And obviously, they were able to get the 3 points and really put themselves in pole position to, you know, get out of the group.
That's right. Well, on to another group. And Morocco, blimey, this game, I can't believe how it went, to be fair. I mean, it's football, so you know, you got to kind of expect the unexpected. But their substitute, Buhudu's put through his own net to give Iran their first World Cup win since 1998. Now, both sides started on the front foot, but it was the Moroccans who had the better chances. And unfortunately for them, they were actually really, really wasteful in front of the goal. But Robbie, Herve Renard said that he was disappointed with the loss, and he actually would have been even more disappointed had it ended in a draw. Now, you can see his point, though, given the chances they missed.
Yeah, absolutely. And even more when you're considering that they didn't even attempt a single shot in the second half. I mean, that just, and I'm talking to Iran, of course, and that just shows how football works for the better or for the worse. And I think, you know, you kind of look at what Carlo Queiroz was doing with this team. You know, you saw the opportunities given to Asmon and obviously other players like them. I mean, it was really an interesting game, so to say. I mean, obviously, you know, you kind of saw Morocco dominate the first half a bit more than Iran, but, you know, certainly it seemed to be a really interesting game, but I feel that Iran really just had the opportunity and took it. I mean, obviously, I think this game would have much more ended into a draw than the last game between Egypt and Uruguay. This one really had a draw going forward, but, you know, unlucky for Morocco heading into this really, really tough group.
Absolutely, man. You mentioned Queiroz earlier. You know, he's always played to his side's strengths, and he actually even admitted the strategy was to frustrate Morocco and hit them once they had, in inverted commas, a mental collapse. You pretty much say it's mission impossible. Well, I should say mission accomplished, actually. Pardon me, mission accomplished.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think such a result like this really helps them well. And obviously, it's going to be a tough group for both these teams heading into their next game. I think Iran plays Spain, if I'm not mistaken. So it's certainly, I think, a good advantage for Iran to, you know, try to try to take advantage and really, you know, I guess, you know, many people really weren't expecting maybe a bit much from both these teams. But now, given the result and given the way that they played, you know, this group could really go close, as one would think.
Yeah, mate. I'll tell you what. Carlos Queiroz, I mean, I obviously support Man United, as you know. and he was Ferguson's assistant manager. And there was a little bit of a joke going around where they called United Fergoz, because Ferguson would always trust Queiroz with tactics and whatnot. And a lot of the time, we'd see Alan Smith in the middle of the park. We'd see Quinton Fortune or Kieran Richardson at left back. And that isn't really something that Alex Ferguson would do, play players out of position unless he really needed to. And you could obviously tell that this was a lot to do with Queiroz's influence. And, you know, he went to Real Madrid, he didn't have a great time. But he's just one of these guys where it's just destructive football, isn't it? As I said before, he tries to work to his team's strengths. And to be fair on the guy, they had a fantastic qualification record. I think they ended up 7 points ahead of South Korea. I think they went 12 games unbeaten, something along those lines. So
they
didn't qualify through the back door, so to speak. So they are a half-decent team. And even though it was against the odds that they won the game, it shouldn't really be that much of a surprise, though, should it?
No, I don't think so. And given the opportunity, and given the way that the group is set up with Spain, Portugal, and Morocco, you know, you really don't expect a lot from them anyway. But yeah, you're right about Queiroz. I mean, you know, I think more than anything, he's always been that manager of making such, you know, drastic change, you know, being much more disciplined and at times even aggressive, but really tactically oriented, as we saw definitely yesterday. You know, it's interesting. And I think maybe for some, he's really underappreciated, but I think now it is really going to be really, really interesting heading into these next two games, especially the last game, assuming that they, you know, get a decent result against Spain. You know, the last game, you know, Queiroz taking on, you know, a team that he's from, you know, he's from Portugal. He managed the Portuguese national team during the 2010 World Cup. He obviously knows the players on them. So, yeah, I mean, what a story that would be. So it's going to be tough. You know, he's always one of, it seems like he's always one of those managers that you feel like is destined for more. I mean, he's obviously been in Iran since 2011. He's already been there for 7 years. You would think that after spending two cycles there that he would leave and try a bigger challenge. But, you know, at 65, you know, the clock is running out. And I think what he's doing here at Iran is great, but now I think it's the time to really put those results and really put in those that time and effort that you've done in qualification to the task. And what better way to do it against a really strong team like Spain and the European champions in Portugal?
Absolutely, mate, absolutely. And that's a lovely segue to the next game that we're going to be discussing. And undoubtedly, it's the game of the tournament because, you know, listen, they're going to be talking about Cristiano Ronaldo making his mark with a hat-trick, a 3-3 draw, and a highly entertaining game. I'm just going to break it down for everyone that obviously may not have seen it. I don't know if you haven't seen it, I don't know where you've been. But yeah, Ronaldo gave Portugal the lead less than 4 minutes from the spot. Diego Costa then levelled after basically bulldozing his way past the Portugal back line. Ronaldo then grabbed his second when his shot slipped past De Gea's hand, and a somewhat uncharacteristic error by the United keeper, although I beg to differ, which I'm not going to really go into again, which I've totally been ripped apart on Twitter about. Costa then added his second with the poacher's finish before Nacho scored what we thought would be the goal of the game. But cometh the hour, cometh the man, and the 25-yard free kick in the dying moments of the game was dispatched by Ronaldo to complete his hat-trick, causing the world to spin on a broken axis. Roberto, what can you say about this game, mate? It had practically everything, didn't it?
It had everything. The only thing that it did lack was a yellow card by Sergio Ramos or even a sending off by one of these guys. But yeah, it had everything. And rightly so, this was going to be always one of the matches to watch for, and it certainly led up to the hype. You know, Cristiano Ronaldo definitely out of this world. Obviously, one of the great performances of his career, to be honest, you know, up there with, obviously they didn't win, but certainly the performance that he does, you know, penalty and you know, scoring that wonderful free kick in the 80th minute. It's really interesting now because, you know, this game was so open-minded and so end-to-end. You know, Portugal scores in the 4th minute, then Costa scores in the 24th, then Ronaldo does it again, then Spain does it again, then, you know, Nacho with that wonderful, wonderful shot outside the box. I mean, for me, that's the goal of the tournament right now, don't you think?
Yeah, well, so far, yeah, absolutely, I agree, mate. And the thing is, you know, I've been watching Ronaldo for years. I was at Old Trafford when he made his debut for United. He came on, he skinned the left back of Bolton, and he skinned the right back. And we knew that there was something special with this kid. And as time went on, he just got better and better. He went to Madrid, and there weren't any doubts about his ability. You know, he killed it from the off. And I've seen so many of his free kicks. He takes like what they call a knuckleball free kick, isn't it? Where he just hits the ball down the centre with the laces, or even his side foot, and he kind of goes everywhere, basically. But on this occasion, it was just precision. It was absolute precision. But from a goalkeeping perspective, now I used to play in goal. I didn't play got in goal from a professional level, obviously. But looking at De Gea's positioning, I have to question it. I'm still questioning it now. I saw a free kick that Pogba took today in the France-Australia game, and Matt Ryan, the goalkeeper, his positioning was perfect. He wasn't dead centre, but he was a little bit left off centre, so he didn't give such a big gap between himself and the far post. And De Gea always seems to do this whenever there's a free kick. I know he's aligned his wall, and I know he's got the two highest or the two tallest players on the end of the wall where Ronaldo's going to put it, so that obviously when they jump, they're going to get something on it. I know the free kick was fantastic. It was very difficult to stop. But had De Gea moved slightly to his left, maybe a yard, 2 yards, he wouldn't have scrambled across to be having to save that. In fact, he didn't even scramble across. He kind of stopped when the ball was in mid-flight. And again, as good as he is as a goalkeeper, as superb as he is or has been as a goalkeeper, that's one of his many flaws that I see. But take nothing away from that free kick. It was absolutely superb.
No, definitely. Absolutely. And yeah, you're right. I think the positioning really affected it. And, you know, obviously a poor game from De Gea right now. From that game, obviously you had that blunder from Ronaldo's second, and then not being able to catch that in the last goal. But, you know, it's really interesting because many people thought that the winner of this game would decide the winner of this group. But now it's all open. It's all open. I mean, Iran is currently on top for the moment. Portugal and Spain with 1 point and Morocco with 0 points. I mean, you know, the second games are the most vital ones for both these teams. But, you know, going back to Ronaldo, I mean, you know, man's on a mission. I think he's on a mission to really become the best player of all time. You know, obviously coming off a third straight Champions League title with Real Madrid, you know, I think he's more motivated than ever. And that just raises the bait for what we saw on today for Lionel Messi as well. But just going back to Ronaldo, I mean, wow, I mean, definitely one of the great performances up there. And hopefully for all the sake of Portuguese fans everywhere, that, you know, it's the first of many more. I think they want Ronaldo like that. And, you know, you saw the team help Ronaldo in the way that he could. And, you know, for Spain, it's going to be interesting now because, you know they sacked Lopetegui just a few days prior. Fernando Hierro is really trying to get all those pieces together. But, you know, I mean, still, I mean, going into this game, you kind of need to... On a Spanish perspective, you would have to be really, really bad for conceding that goal and just, you know, be frustrated with that, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I think I'd be more frustrated with Ronaldo's second goal, to be fair, because that should be meat and drink for the goalkeeper, as far as I'm concerned. You know, it wasn't a deflection. The ball didn't skid off the surface. He just took his eye off the ball. And again, going back to the many flaws of De Gea, I just think that his concentration levels aren't all there. I mean, I don't know. Again, he might have just been having a bad day the other night. You know, we saw with Karius where he dropped a couple of clangers and people were pointing out the mistakes that he's made throughout his Liverpool career, which is understandable. But De Gea at 27 years old, he shouldn't be making these mistakes. I know the greats have done it, you know, especially, you know, your Peter Schmeichel. I've seen him do it myself, you know, in an FA Cup game against Barnsley where he's gone to clear the ball and he's basically swiped at it and it's got some backspin. And the strikers just put it in the back of the net. We've seen Fabian Barthez make mistakes. But the thing is with David De Gea, and, you know, this is actually going to lead me on to another question I'm going to ask you about him. You know, he hit out at the Spanish press saying he doesn't receive much support from them, or Spain, which I presume he meant the Spanish press. Is he right, or do you think the Spanish press are actually justified? Because for me, And again, you know, this is for you to argue. Living in the UK, I've seen so many and I've read so many articles about De Gea. They laud him, which is understandable, and I get it. But the thing is, it seems that he gets a free pass at United because he has been the fans' player of the season, because he has made some remarkable saves to keep United in a respectable position. I think that he makes mistakes and people say, well, you know, it's okay because, you know, he's kept United in games. But for me, that's not good enough. That really isn't good enough. You can't turn around and say to a goalkeeper, it's okay, you can make a few mistakes because you saved us in the past. That's not how it should be. You're setting a trend here. What do you think? Is he getting an unfair deal by the Spanish?
I think when you're looking at, you know, playing for the big clubs, you're obviously going to have much more of an advantage. I mean, you know, people are not really talking about Keylor Navas as one of the best goalkeepers in the world, and he's won 3 straight Champions League. You know, and obviously they're 2 different players whatsoever, but the thing with De Gea, yes, it is that factor of, you know, obviously when you look at the Spanish national team, there are so many players that are playing in Spain, you know, playing for Real Madrid, playing for Barcelona, playing for Atletico Madrid, that you're more aligned to them rather than players like David De Gea who play abroad, or, you know, maybe Azpilicueta or some, maybe with the exception of a David Silva, who, you know, obviously is a great player. It's kind of harsh to say because, you know, this is a goalkeeper that is basically filling in for someone who, you know, Iker Casillas in this matter, who was such a mainstay of this team, you know, won everything for them, and to fill those big shoes is hard. And I think I get that, you know, this is his first major World Cup, 27 years old, but he's still in the prime of his career. And maybe it's just that. Maybe it's just the overreaction. And I think that I don't think one game should really. And I'll ask you this because I've been seeing this as well on Twitter recently. I mean, you know, I don't think one game should really slander him off and say that he's not the best in the world right now. I think that's ridiculous.
No, mate, I agree with you. Listen, the way I see it is that, you know, people can say, oh, you know, is this guy the best player in the world? Is this guy the best goalkeeper? Is this guy the best defender? I judge it based on form. Now, right. I wouldn't say Manuel Neuer is the best goalkeeper in the world because he's hardly played any games. So how can you say that he's the best? He's been on the sidelines.
Right.
Do you know what I'm saying? Whereas De Gea has been consistent this season, you know, he's and to be fair on the guy, and this is the praise I've got to give him, you could talk about Ederson, you know, not conceding as many goals as De Gea and whatnot, you know, but Ederson's got a fantastic back line in front of him. De Gea's had effectively 2 failed wingers at fullback in Young and Valencia, and then a central defensive pairing that could be anyone, take your pick, because Jose has been chopping and changing because injuries, suspensions, or he just doesn't trust certain guys. So, you know, how can the goalkeeper feel at ease when he doesn't know his back line? I mean, we've seen it in the past, the great defences. Look at the great Milan defence in 94. Look at the great Barcelona defence. Look at all the great defences. You can pick them, can't you? If it's a back four, you know which back four is going to go in there. But that gives the goalkeeper confidence. When you've got David De Gea there, who is a fantastic goalkeeper, don't get me wrong, when he looks at his back line, he's thinking, oh, well, is Luke Shaw going to play at left back? Is Rojo going to play at left back? Is Damian going to play at right back? So he doesn't know. He really doesn't know. And, you know, that's what I've got to say about the guy. You know, he's been performing extremely well, given the shit back line that he's had in front of him. But my main gripe with him about what you said about the Spanish press is, well, you know, yeah, they're very critical. They're highly critical because they've got standards. If he went to Real Madrid, can you imagine the stick that he'd get? I mean, Keylor Navas gets enough shit as it is from the Spanish press, right? And he's not even Spanish. So you can imagine if the Spanish international goes to Real Madrid and makes the mistakes that he's been making, he'd get eaten alive out of there. And I think that's one of the reasons why he hasn't gone to Real Madrid. I honestly believe it. Because they will be so... I mean, Marca already harsh on other clubs, let alone their own. You know, if he went to Barcelona, I don't think he'd get as much because they're Catalan. So, and the Catalan press are very, very good with their players, as far as I understand, anyway. But if David De Gea decided to go to Real Madrid, he would have it difficult. And I think that's one of the reasons why he hasn't gone. Because I think he fears going to Real Madrid. At United, he's got it kind of easy because the fans love him, the social media in the UK love him, the press love him, he's an Adidas boy, so they'll look after him. And the way that they market him in the UK will be different to Madrid. I just think that he doesn't have the mentality to be at a Real Madrid. Honestly, don't.
And he has to do this right now if he ever is going to go. I mean, at such a crucial age, you know, when are you ever going to have an opportunity to do it? But I think, you know, staying at Manchester United is going to be difficult for him, you know, to obviously be successful. You know, obviously he wants to win more titles, you know, win a Champions League, win a Premier League, win all of that. And I feel that, you know, unfortunately he could get frustrated and you know, go for bigger opportunities. And that bigger opportunity could be Real Madrid or even Atletico Madrid, given the given their recent success, I would say, in the Europa League. But, yeah, I mean, it's certainly a game, this one, between Portugal and Spain. Obviously, you know, it's going to be tough now heading into these second games for both these teams. I'll ask you this, though, posing this question to you. I mean, you know, who's under more pressure now heading into the second game? Because obviously you see Spain play Iran, who just come off the win against Morocco, and you see Portugal taking on this Moroccan side that's going with, that I'm sure is going to go with everything heading into this game.
I think the pressure is mostly on Cristiano Ronaldo instead of either side, to be fair, because when you've just had a performance like that, scoring a hat-trick against one of the tournament favourites, and then you're going into a game against, you know, an unfancied side, everyone is going to be expecting him to deliver. Now, if he doesn't, then they'll say, oh, well, you know, he's not the greatest of all time. And then Messi might score in his next game, and then he's the greatest of all time. So I think the pressure is more on Ronaldo. What you got to bear in mind, and you know, in my notes earlier made, I was actually saying, you know, it isn't really the same. It isn't the same conservative Portugal that we saw in Euro 2016, was it? It's just they seem, how can I put it, they seem more expansive. They seem more committed to getting more men forward than they were in Euro 2016. And it just seemed that with Euro 2016, a lot of the players there, they didn't, how can I put it, it was more like damage limitation for most of the games, and they scraped out of their group as one of the lucky third place teams. So I think there's a bit more pressure for them to deliver, but I think the most pressure is on Ronaldo. I don't think that there will be as much pressure on Spain, because we saw how they took Portugal apart, and had it not been for a goalkeeping error, they would have won the game. You know, they came back from behind, they showed character, spirit, determination. You know, Iniesta was buzzing, and he's, what, 36 years old? You know,
yep.
Diego Costa scored two fantastic goals. Vintage Diego Costa. So I don't think there's as much pressure on Spain. I think that the press knew that, you know, this game probably came at the right time for him. You know, being the first game, being the first game for Hierro, get the difficult one out of the way. And then you got the simple two to come. So I think that the pressure is mostly on Ronaldo to deliver it, as opposed to either of the nations. What do you think?
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think when you're looking at the standards that he has, and especially for Portugal coming off their European Championship, when, you know, they want to demonstrate to themselves that they are the best in the continent, and, you know, they want to super succeed, even though, you know, there are, you know, low standards because of the opponents that they have to face in this World Cup. But yeah, there's always that idea of, you know, we want to beat the best, you know, we need to do so, and we need to get the best out of our captain, who, you know, and we need him to do performances like this. You know, we need him to be at this level and to really, you know, as a team, help out. Maybe something that a team down south in the in Latin America can't do, unfortunately.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Absolutely. Right, let's move over to Group C. And it began with a team that you can, well, a team that you can call, I don't, you know what, over here we say on paper. When you look at this team on paper, they can achieve great things. Belgium, on paper, they can achieve great things, because when you read the list of their players on paper, they look fantastic. Same applies with France. Now, they narrowly beat Australia 2-1, and Denmark made the most of their clear-cut chance to punish Peru with a 1-0 win. Now, Rob, France just looked really laboured in the first half. I mean, they just seemed happy to let Australia play the ball about in their own half. You know, lump the ball forward and hope that Varane or whoever can tidy it up. But they stepped the gear in the second half. They took the lead through a Griezmann penalty, a decision that required VAR. What's your actual take on the incident? And are you happy with the way VAR was used?
Yes, I am. Because you kind of look at the, you know, you saw the contact there made to Griezmann. And, you know, rightly so. I mean, this is a team that, you know, got a penalty from VAR. You know, 4 years ago, they got the gold light technology call. So yeah, it's certainly, but I wasn't impressed. Definitely so. I wasn't impressed by this French side. And, you know, I think obviously, you know, not taking into consideration the friendly against the United States last week, you know, it was just, it was not really a convincing victory. And, you know, you have to realize that even, you know, with all due respect to Australia, you know, France and their standards, you know, they had to come out with a really good win. And, you know, 2-1 is okay. It's great because you get 3 points. But, you know, you really start to be a bit skeptical of what you've been able to do, especially considering the talent that you have to your disposal. I feel that there was just a bit too much individualistic things from France. It was tough. I mean, it was a tough game. I mean, you know, I feel that there was, like, you know, zero rotation and movement from the forwards. You know, I feel that they were too linear. You know, I also feel like their first move was always the same. And, you know, Australia broke them down. Australia really broke them down to really a good game. I don't know. I don't feel convinced yet because, you know, on paper, yes, I agree. On paper, this team is one of the favorites to win the World Cup. But when it all comes into play, you know, it just looks shaken. And, you know, this is something that I'm sure you're going to agree with, though. I mean, France would be a much, much stronger and tactically better team than they are if they just had a different manager.
I 100% agree with you, mate. And the thing is, the most surprising thing about this is Deschamps was effectively the midfield destroyer. He knew how to break up play. And there's nothing in that in this French team. I'm looking at the lineup, and then I remember watching the first 15, 20 minutes of this game, and I thought, yeah, you know, these teams they take a bit of time to feel each other out, so to speak. You know, it's like a boxing match, you know, the first couple of rounds, you know, it's kind of cagey. There isn't really much going on. But when Australia are passing the ball 20 yards upfield in their own half with no pressure whatsoever, I'm looking at the likes of Kylian Mbappe, blessed with pace, plays for one of the biggest teams in the world, if not the biggest team in France, right? He's done it in the Champions League, scored goals. I look at Dembele, plays for Barcelona. He's done it in the Bundesliga, he's won La Liga title. I'm looking at Griezmann, and we know how good he is. And I'm thinking, you guys have got so much talent, right? The fact that your name is on that team sheet should petrify the opposition. And here you are, standing off them, happy to let them have the ball. Now, this is obviously down to the manager. Because he's saying to him, okay, we'll let them push up high, and then, you know, if they're going to lump the ball forward, and then we'll eat up and then start from our end. But what he didn't take into consideration, Deschamps, is that Australia were pressing. They were forcing France backwards, forcing the ball back to Lloris to lock the ball forward. And I'm sitting there thinking, Australia have the ball. Press them. Force them into making mistakes, because they're a very inexperienced back line. Very inexperienced. I know Jedinak was sitting in front of them, you know, marshalling them and you know, issuing instructions. But there's only so much he can do. When you've got those three players that I mentioned, blessed with so much ability, so much pace, you've got to scare them. Force them back. Force them to make the goalkeeper work. Force him to play the ball out for throw-ins or whatever, and then you retain the play. It frustrated me, and I don't even support France. It was baffling.
Yeah, I agree. I absolutely agree. I mean, and that's going to be really difficult heading into this next game, because, you know, obviously coming to another, we'll talk about this game later, but, you know, taking on a Peruvian side that's going to go out with everything into this game. And, you know, France really need to put themselves into a really good position to really just go out there and get the more opportunities that they can. The one thing I will say is that, you know, I feel that perhaps some changes need to be made into the second game. I mean, you know, maybe you would start Giroud. I mean, what do you think, Stel?
Giroud gives you that physical presence up top. And I've rated Giroud for a long time. I mean, you know, throughout this season, you know, in fact, for the past couple of seasons, I've been saying, you know, he's one of the best one-touch finishers I've seen in the Premier League. He gives defenders so much hassle with his strength. He's good in the air. He gives you that extra bit of physicality up front when you're lacking it, and Chelsea have obviously thrived, and he's thrived since he's joined Chelsea. The thing is, it surprised me how he hasn't started, because traditionally, if you look at Deschamps' previous teams, he's always had a big man up top. With Monaco, he had Morientes. With Juventus, he had Trezeguet. At Marseille, he had I forget the Ivorian striker's name, I forget it, it's just gone out of my head, but, you know, he had another physical striker up top. And I'm thinking, well, if you're going to play three up top, you've got to have a physical presence, a guy that can hold up the ball and then allow the wide men to come into play. Now, he started off with Mbappe in the central role, Griezmann on the right, expecting him to track back and help your right back? For me, I'm thinking, look, I'm no master tactician. I don't have my UEFA A license. I haven't won World Cups as a player. And I haven't got to Champions League finals as a coach like Deschamps had. But at the same time, I'm thinking, is he picking these players because of their name? Or is he picking them because he actually believes that this system works with the players that he's got? For me, it was just all wrong. And I think Giroud should start the next game. And possibly Dembele should be dropped because he didn't do anything today to warrant a starting place.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think you got much more from the midfield and even from Griezmann as well. Mbappe did have those opportunities as well, but you know it was really just a battle in the midfield essentially.
No, I agree. And going back to Giroud, mate, the other thing that people don't realise is that when you got a central striker like I said with Giroud, someone that's strong and physical, that's good in the air, he draws defenders out. And what you'll see a central defender always in the back of him. All he needs is a flick on. And then if you've got players that making diagonal runs out wide with pace and intelligence, they'll get in behind you. We saw it in the cup final. You know, the ball was played to Eden Hazard. And Phil Jones, not only was he 5 yards, square of Hazard, he gave him so much room to make that run. And that's what central strikers do. They pull defenders out of position. It makes them think twice as to where the positioning is. They're thinking, do I go with the forward or do I hang back? You know, I remember United played Liverpool. And I'm digressing. I remember United played Liverpool, I think 2002, 2003. And Laurent Blanc was at the back. And Gerard Houllier had picked Emil Heskey as a central striker. And the first 5-10 minutes, Liverpool were lumping balls up to Emil Heskey. And Laurent Blanc was staying on him. But every time he stayed on him, touched tight, Heskey was flicking the ball on. It only takes two times for Laurent Blanc to think, right, okay, I don't need to go up to him. All I'm going to do, I'm going to take 5 or 6 yards. I'm going to stay 5 or 6 yards behind him, so that when he flicks the ball on, there's no one going to be there because I'm going to be the person taking it. And that's the difference between having an intelligent, world-class defender and just a defender that wants to do this whole kamikaze defending. And this is again segues galore today. Kamikaze defending, Umtiti. What in the world was he thinking with that handball?
Awful, really bad decision made by him, and you should expect much more given the standard that he's been giving at Barcelona. You know, doing such a thing like that is unacceptable.
Yeah, I agree, mate. And you're thinking, as you said, someone with that experience, someone that's played at the top level, especially for Barcelona this season, he shouldn't be making the mistakes. But you know, when Australia equalised through the penalty, did you think they could hold on? Because to be fair, France didn't really do too much.
Right. No. I thought of that. You know, I was thinking to myself that they would hold back and really just hold on to that result against France, and that would have been much more bigger. But you kind of think France were lucky to get the win. I don't know. I just had this feeling that they were lucky with the win as well.
No, I agree, mate. I agree. And the winning goal was somewhat fortuitous. You know, Paul Pogba grabbed the winner. At first glance, I thought it was an own goal, but it wasn't. And it was another goal that required technology. This time it was goal line technology. Now, a lot has been made about Pogba's recent performances for the national team. I know he was booed in a recent friendly against Italy. So, in your opinion, what do you think it would take for him to be finally accepted or even forgiven by the French?
In this tournament, or are you just talking about like heading into the next game?
In general, mate.
Win the World Cup. I mean, that's all you have to do. I mean, obviously, he did score. I mean, that's obviously one thing to do. And, you kind of need to get that pressing, influence that, hasn't been having for quite some time. And rightly so. He's always been harshed as being just a marketing player and an Instagram, a social media player is what I saw on Twitter today. He needs to put out great performances and he needs to get the support from these players. And that's how essentially what he needs to do, just go out there, obviously score, but also have that, ability as a midfielder to really, provide passes, be a playmaker, and essentially just, try to boss it up into the midfield like he usually should do. And that's I think, how he's going to win it. And I think obviously winning the hearts of French people would be winning the World Cup, and because their standards are high as well. And But it's going to be tough now, heading into the, you know, after this game. It's not a good example to come by.
Yeah, no, I agree, mate. Absolutely, absolutely. Right, you probably know this, but I've got a bit of a soft spot for Peru and was absolutely gutted for them today. I mean, they missed so many chances, but that's how it goes. It's an unforgivable game. And, you know, Christian Cueva, who's so highly rated, ballooned his penalty over the bar with the game locked at 0-0. Do you put it down to nerves or maybe a bit of cockiness? Because I saw the way he stepped up to take that penalty. He did a little shimmy, which I don't really like seeing. What's your take on that?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think, you know, obviously not being in a World Cup after 36 years could put a lot of pressure on these players. You know, obviously it was a bit kind of, it was weird not seeing a player like Guerrero, who obviously is trying to come back into the system that he has been playing for quite some time, you know, played a few friendlies ever since his reinstatement to the national team. But you kind of have to figure that, you know, such a player like him, and you saw the missed chances that they had, and Denmark were great. I mean, Denmark really had a great plan of trying to stop this this Peruvian team going forward. And yeah, I mean, going back to Cueva, yeah, really unlucky. And I don't know what he was doing there. I don't know why anyone would try to attempt a, you know, basically a Simone Zaza style penalty. Like, yeah. No, why would you do that? It's not. It usually doesn't go well.
Yeah, absolutely. And Denmark, their counter-attacking system worked really well, mate. They gave you know, Peru a lot of problems. I know Peru like to get men forward, so obviously they're going to be susceptible to defensive errors. The winner was a textbook counter-attacking football, wasn't it? I mean, Eriksen's pass to Poulsen was weighted perfectly, and the finish was top draw.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I think it was a great performance. And also, we you kind of have to, and obviously, you know, you kind of have to give a soft spot to him, is, you know, you kind of have to credit Schmeichel's performance as well. I thought it was great. I thought it was really great today.
Yeah, his dad was better, though. Just saying.
Oh, no, absolutely.
Right, anything Ronaldo can do, Messi has to do better, and vice versa. Now, unfortunately for the little Argentinian, he fell short, no pun intended. He was anonymous for most of the 1-1 draw against Iceland. When the opportunity came up to be the hero again, his penalty was saved. Now, Rob, this isn't the first time Messi has failed to make an impact at international level. Nope. Why do you think this is, mate? I mean, my view is the comparisons between him and Maradona are actually starting to play on his mind. Would you agree?
No, because I'll tell you why. Because, you know, he's been having this for a long time, and I think that he doesn't, obviously I don't know Messi personally, but at least what I'm hearing is that, you know, he obviously doesn't care about that. I think obviously, certainly what the Argentine media and the public are saying is, you know, this guy is just trying to do everything that he could to lead Argentina the way that Maradona did, but it's just so different now with the way that the game has been played. And, you know, obviously, you know, you're talking about a once-in-a-lifetime player like Messi just doing so well at Barcelona all over these years, that heading into Argentina, and rightly so. I mean, he was harshly criticized early on in his career for not, you know, repeating his performances that he does at Barcelona or Argentina. But then something clicked, and he realized that, you know, he wanted to become that main player and you know, obviously did that, you know, at the start during the 2014 cycle. But now heading into this cycle, and such a catastrophic cycle as well. I mean, you know, a team that obviously had a really, really bad, I don't know if I can curse here, but a really bad, really shit performance in World Cup qualifying. The preparation was bad. You know, I mean, my God, you're telling me you're going to go into a group of death with Iceland, with Croatia, with Nigeria, and you're only playing one friendly against Haiti? And with the talent that you have, it's still not going to work. It's that whole debate. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, contemporary football fans here are probably going to change their opinion, and maybe some don't, on Messi and Ronaldo, that whole thing, and even more so than him and Maradona. But I don't think it's down to him mainly. And obviously, Stella, you definitely have an idea. You have a whole different idea of this, but, you know, it's just the team isn't functioning correctly. And, you know, obviously Agüero did score the first goal, but, you know, credit to Iceland, really. I mean, their defense and their grit was really, really, that really stand out. But you're not going to win games with that defense, and especially a goalkeeper, Willy Caballero. It's it's unimpressive for me, absolutely. And then, and I think something like this was, you know, and I said it, you know, I said Iceland would win. I didn't say Argentina would lose per se. Oh, actually, I did say Iceland would beat Argentina, but such a performance like this, it's not looking good. And you know, it's frustrating now. And I think all the pressures now are heading into Messi, you know, as the number one person that is always getting criticized by the fans in Argentina and by everyone else. You know, he's always number one on that list. It's not, you know, it's not players, it's not the defense, it's not the goalkeeper, it's not the, you know, it's not the midfielders, it's always the captain.
No, I agree with you, mate, but see, this is the thing. I mean, watching Argentina from, say, 86, I mean, I don't remember much of the 86 World Cup because I was 5 years old, but I do remember Italian 90, I do remember USA 94, I do remember, you know, France 98 and all these other World Cups I've been since. And the one thing Argentina have lacked isn't ability. They've had stars in every single squad, but it's leadership. And the only squad I can really think of since Italian 90 that they've really had any leaders was World Cup 98, when they got knocked out by the Dutch. And that was, even then they were quite unlucky. It was just a moment of Bergkamp brilliance which killed them. You know, but they had leaders all over that team. But look at this current crop of players, and this is like another golden generation for them. You've got Di Maria, you've got Aguero, Higuain, Messi, and so on and so forth, right? But it just seems to me that this team doesn't have any leaders. And by that, I mean, I don't mean like a player that can, you know, pull you out of the mire, because Messi has done it. We saw him in that final qualifier where he got the hat-trick. He basically dragged them to that World Cup. But someone that talks in the dressing room, someone that is vociferous, someone that has presence, I don't think Messi has that. He doesn't seem, I've never really seen him, you know, G up his players, or, you know, against Chile in the Copa America finals, I didn't see anything of him. I really didn't. But then I'm looking at Chile, and you got Vargas, and you got what's the fella, the midfielder that's a Bayern Munich, I forget his name, has gone out of my head now.
Vidal.
You know, you've got all these players, Alexis Sanchez, and they've got that in them. But Argentina don't. And Messi doesn't have it. I don't want to bring Ronaldo into this again, because I don't think it's fair, these comparisons. I really don't. But, you know, look at that European Championship final for Portugal. He was on the touchline, geeing his players on, because he wasn't on the pitch. Would Messi do that? I don't think so. And I think when I said that Messi shouldn't, maybe Argentina are better off without Messi, I just think that because he's in the team, a lot of these players are looking at him as the focal point. They're looking at him saying, right, you can do it. And they're taking it for granted that he's there. I think if Messi isn't there, then every player gets responsibility for their own actions. Whereas now, whenever Argentina lose, the first person they blame is Messi, regardless of whether he's had a good game or not. It's always, when Messi didn't pull out a performance out of his ass. And then they blame the coach. There isn't any blame on Aguero. There isn't any blame on Higuain. Higuain missed a hatful of chances in that World Cup final, but no one says anything.
Nope.
No one says anything at all. Di Maria has been shocking for the national team for the past couple of seasons.
Yep.
You know? Rojo, Mascherano. These are players that have played in big games, but yet no one pulls them up on it. And I think, you know, as much as I'm not a massive Messi fan, I think he gets a hard deal. And I don't think it's fair. I really don't think it's fair. So I think that perhaps if Messi does call it a day, or maybe if he did call it a day beforehand, you might see a better Argentina, because players would be having to play for their places. But now it's like, well, I'm going to play, because even if we have a shit game, he's going to get the blame for it. It ain't going to be us.
And that's the sad reality of it, I think. And, you know, you're comparing two personalities as well still. I mean, you know, Messi is a reserved, you know, basically introvert. You know, he doesn't say much, you know, even when you're seeing in his interviews or on and off the pitch. Ronaldo, I mean, my God, he's, you know, very eccentric, you know, outspoken. And obviously, we've seen that over various occasions. You know, he is that type of player. It's tough because, you know, that's the thing, and I think that's the problem that Argentina have been having for quite some time, that the players don't know how to play for Lionel Messi. And, you know, Sampaoli saying, oh, this is more Messi's team than Sampaoli's team. I mean, what is this? Is that really something that the coach should say? Is that really something that you're going to put all this dependency on Lionel Messi? and not on you, who, you know, obviously you've won a Copa America. You are a good manager, mind you. I mean, I don't want to say he's mediocre or anything. He is a good manager, and rightly so. But if you're going to really call this team Messi's team rather than your own team, what good is it?
That's right. I agree. But that's only putting even more pressure on Messi. That's
right.
Putting even more pressure, because it just seems that, you know, I know he may have meant it maybe tongue-in-cheek, because obviously Messi is the main man. But at the same time, it's almost as if Sampaoli is kind of like distancing himself from any criticism or any blame for what happens. It is a shitty situation for the guy. Like I said, I'm not his biggest fan, but in this instance, I feel sorry for him, because let's be 100% honest. When I asked you about the whole pressure dealing with Maradona being about, I mean, Maradona is at almost every Argentina game, so that doesn't help for a start.
No.
Secondly, you know, from what I understand, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems that there's a lot more love for Maradona in Argentina than there is for Messi.
Absolutely, 100%. No, you're right on that. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, well, yeah, because, you know, you're looking at two different personalities on here. I mean, you know, the comparisons with him and Maradona are tremendously different and at the same as well. You know, Messi and Maradona did play the same position, wore number 10, captain of the national team, you know, played in Europe, you know, scored a lot of goals, you know, really, you know, short stature as well. But, you know, as a person, I mean, still, I'm sure you saw that photo of Maradona smoking a Cuban cigar in a stadium where it says no tobacco is allowed. I mean, that's all you have to say. That's just the tip of the iceberg of what Maradona is, an extroverted, controversial character who rose to greatness from his really, really humble beginnings, basically the slums. You know, and you look at Messi coming from that lower middle class background, you know, from Rosario, never played in Argentina ever. You know, he went to Barcelona and started his career there. You know, very unassuming, reserved, and, you know, he doesn't stand out. You know, and that's the kind of the false perception that many people, I mean, my God, I mean, this guy gets criticized because he doesn't sing the anthem. And you're telling me that this guy is supposed to be loved by his fans? I mean, I'm sure he ignores it. I mean, obviously, you know, when you're Messi, you have to deal with so many other important things. But I'm sure that kind of gets into your head a bit. I mean, if your own country is going at you because you're this great player that is able to do remarkable things in Barcelona and become such a talented player, that, you know, why would you settle for something more? And, you know, I feel that he really is someone that cares for his national team. He cares about Argentina a lot more than one would think, but it's just now is never. Now, you know, now is the time, because, you know, you don't know if you get another opportunity. And if you want to put yourself up with the greats like Pelé and Maradona, which, you know, even people saying that even if Messi does win this World Cup, he will never be like Maradona. You know, some people always say he's already surpassed Maradona. You're never going to get a really good answer, but I think for his sake, I think he really wants this World Cup to, you know, just make the people in this country happy about him and just go on from there, and to always be remembered and, you know, not just be remembered for being such a wonderful, wonderful player who was able to do things at Barcelona and never nothing for the Argentine team. I mean, yes, he is the top goal scorer for the national team, but, you know, in Argentina, the standards are held high. You know, it's the sky or hell for them. You know, it's win or, you know, lose. That's essentially it. That I can't think of a media or fans more cutthroat toward their players and to their superstars, in this case Lionel Messi, as for the last few years, than Argentina.
Yeah, you're right. You're right, mate.
But credit to Iceland. I mean, you know, obviously their first ever World Cup game. You know, great performance by Fingvinson, you know, great performance by Halldórsson to save Messi's penalty in the second half. I mean, you know, you have to give credit to Iceland for coming in out there and you know, going against all the odds of putting in that defensive resistance and just, you know, that grit that they've been known for. And, you know, I think they should keep their head high despite not winning. I mean, you know, this is a monumental result for them.
Yeah, that's right, mate. That's right. And, you know, as you said, Messi's miss has dominated the headlines, but Iceland, not for the first time, showed they're no pushovers. Do you think they'll have such a conservative approach against Nigeria and Croatia, mate?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's all you need to do heading into these really important games, because now it's just, you know, trying to get the points that you need and getting the wins that you need to get out of this really, really tough group. And rightly so, after today's result between Croatia and Nigeria, now all the pressure's on all these teams to just, you know, failure's not an option. And heading into the next game, it's going to be tough, because both those teams are coming out for everything, and rightly so.
That's right, mate. Absolutely. Well, Croatia opened their campaign with a straightforward win over Nigeria. Robbie, it was a 2-0 scoreline, mate. Nothing spectacular, but Croatia were really threatened and hardly broke a sweat. Now, both of their goals came from defensive errors. The first was an own goal, and the second one came from the spot after some diabolical defending. was it as bad as Mtiti? I think it was actually worse, to be fair. It was sloppy, to say the least, wasn't it?
Right. No, definitely sloppy. I think from the set pieces, you know, that's something that African teams have been able to suffer for quite some time. And, you know, Croatia, you know, credit to them to get the results that they needed. With that great midfield, of course, you know, you have Modric, Rakitic, Mandzukic, and many other players. I mean, they kind of, it seemed unconvincing at once, but, you know, they were able to get the job right in the end. I mean, I think for Nigeria now is to really just go out there and just deploy all their strength into these next few games and really, and I remember just talking to a few African colleagues of mine, you know, they really want to go out there and play their all when taking on these big teams and, you know, doing such a thing. It's unacceptable, you know, to concede a goal off the set piece and to really just go on forward and perform as you can. It's unacceptable, and rightly so for Croatia. They were able to get the good win on this one, and you know, put them into good momentum heading into the next game against Argentina, which, you know, for Argentina it's a final, and for Croatia they could take it into their advantage of winning the group.
See, the thing is, right, I mean, I don't buy into what the hipsters like, you know, and a lot of fuss has been made about about Nigeria's kit. And I'm sure you've seen my tweets about them. And to be fair, look, I don't have anything against Nigeria as a team. I don't have anything against the people or anything. I just think that you've got to judge a team based on their ability. And they've got a handful of good players. You know, we've seen Moses, we've seen Kelechi Iheanacho, we've seen Alex Iwobi, and a few others, John Obi Mikel. But defensively, they are so naive. I don't know whether it's inexperience. I mean, a lot of their players play abroad anyway, so it's not as if they play in the Nigerian league. But, you know, a lot of them should know better. And that kind of defending on Mandzukic, I know Mandzukic is a physical striker. I know he's good in the air. But he wasn't getting anywhere near that ball. He wasn't getting anywhere near it. There was no need to climb all over him. And let's be honest, he was moving away from goal. So even a near post flick on wasn't a possibility because the ball was too high for him. Why he's got his arms all over him, I do not understand.
No, I don't either.
But hey, anyway. Right, mate, before I let you go, there's 3 games tomorrow. Dare I ask which one you're looking forward to seeing the most?
Well, definitely the Germany-Mexico game is really going to be a big one for, you know, just, you know, Germany trying to get back on winning ways to repeat their World Cup title. Mexico, obviously a country that's always been under pressure for many years. And I think with Osorio now, it's now or never to really, you know, and he said in his press conference that he's going to go out and beat Germany. And I think that confidence is going to help them, but it's going to be a very tough game. And, you know, I mean, it's time for the boys from Brazil. It's time for them to really put on a show and see what they're made of on the big stage, because we've seen them in World Cup qualifying, we're seeing in friendlies. Let's see what Chichi can do with this team, you know, with Neymar, Gabriel Jesus, and all the talent that they're able to have at their disposal. It's now the time to really, you know, provide a good impression, a first impression.
That's right, and Marcelo is the captain. He's got the captain's armband. He's someone that can lead a team, isn't he?
Well, it's interesting because I don't think if you know this or not, but, you know, Chichi has always been going for this basically rodizo or rotation of the captaincy on this Brazilian side, you know, so he's basically every game that he's managed, he's had a different captain for his team. One day it's Neymar, one day it's Thiago Silva, one day it's Alisson, one day it's Marcelo. I think it's good because it provides leadership and it really, you know, tells the, and I think what Chichi's trying to put out is really telling the team, you guys each have a mission. You guys each have something that you're able to do to help this team. And if you guys can do to help this team move forward, we're going to win. That's all he needs to do. The way, all they have to do is do in their work and put in that, you know, resistance and play to their best as they can. That provides that leadership to realize that there is no standout player. You know, obviously Neymar is perhaps the standout player in this case, but you know what Chichi's trying to do is tell the people, yeah, you know, we're all the same. It doesn't matter if you're the third string goalkeeper or if you're, you know, the starting striker for the Brazilian national team. You guys all have a job to do, and if you can follow through to that, we're going to go far. And obviously going far means to win. But I think when you look at leadership, yeah, I think Marcelo has it. I think he's really that outspoken figure. We see that at Real Madrid. We see the kind of player that he is. I mean, I feel that there's no one better on this team to lead the Brazilian national team, even though they will switch their captains in this World Cup, than Marcelo.
Great stuff, Robbie. You know what, mate? Can I just ask you one more question before I let you go?
Sure.
Marcelo Bielsa, have you heard the news?
I have.
Leeds. United. What is going on?
It's a one-off. I mean, I've never thought I would see such a thing happen. I mean, yes, he's always been that cult manager and very controversial, but, oh my God, how more controversial can you get than Leeds United? And you kind of see that because, you know, Bilbao, Marseille, Lazio, Lille. Now Leeds United, I mean...
He likes the L's.
Yeah. Something. I don't know. It's interesting. It's really interesting because, you know, obviously there's the language factor as well. That certainly has to be an issue. But I don't know. I honestly don't know where this can go. This could go really bad or this can go really good, to be fair. But, you know, I, to be honest, I haven't seen Leeds play, so I don't know what to expect. But definitely see a lot of high pressing, that's for sure.
Well, see, this is the thing. I mean, when they Leeds United, they've become a bit of a joke club, to be honest. I mean, I can't even. I've lost count how many managers they've had in the past three or four seasons. It's ridiculous. I mean, we had I think one of their owners, their previous owner, didn't like a certain number, so he removed that number from the seat in the stadium. So that, I think it was number 17. He thought that number was unlucky, so he removed the number 17 from any seats in the ground. So it's just preposterous. They're a big club. They're a very, very big club in the UK. You know, for a championship side, they've got a very good average attendance. I think it's in the early 30,000s. So they've got a big fan base, got big history. They want to be back in the Premier League, but a lot of rebuilding needs to be done. The problem with the championship is that because you've got about 46 games, I think it is. I think you've got 46 games. It's very, very difficult to get out of. We've seen teams squander long leads, and we're talking 12 points, 14 point leads at the top, and they've ruined it. And then even if you don't make automatic promotion, you got the playoffs. So effectively, you could end, third, fourth, sixth, and still get promoted. We've seen Aston Villa suffer. They got to the final this season. They lost in the final to Fulham. So it's a very unforgiving league. And, you know, there's going to be game after game after game. It's going to be Saturday, Wednesday, Sunday, Tuesday. It's going to be very difficult. I'll be very surprised if he lasts till December. Really do. And we're talking about a guy that quit Lazio after 2 days. So, you know.
That's the thing. As long as he gets what he wants and has everything that he needs, he will, you know, succeed to the best that he can. If he doesn't get what he needs, he's out the door. Adios.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, good luck to the guy. I'll tell him now he's going to need it. He really is going to need it. But anyway. Well, Robbie, thanks very much for your time, man. Before I let you go, would you like to tell our listeners your Twitter handle and how they can get in contact with you and listen to your show?
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, you know, everyone is welcome to, you know, say slander to me or anything, praise. but yeah, it is at Roberto Rojas 97. Yes, that is a pun intended. Well, not pun, but at least a reference to the birth year. So you could now figure out how old I am. Okay. Sorry to make you feel old, still.
That's all right.
You can follow me there. I'm obviously on Little Limit Football with my co-host Joe Usolo every Monday night. We've been doing a lot of shows heading into the World Cup. We just finished off our Player Spotlight, where we featured one big player from one of the big favorites to win the World Cup. We've done a Messi show, we've done a Ronaldo show, Griezmann, Neymar, and Thomas Muller, and of course David De Gea. And we come off of 32 World Cup previews for each of the 32 teams in this World Cup that we've been doing since the beginning of the year. And yeah, I mean, we're on for a really good show that we've been doing every Monday night. And you know, it's incredible now. It's been 4 years since I've been on this show, and time goes by fast, is all I can say.
Absolutely, mate. You know, you've had some incredible guests. I'm not putting myself in that list, but you've had some...
Top tier, man.
Cheers, mate. But no, seriously, you've had some fantastic guests. Your content is absolutely fantastic. And long may it continue. I really appreciate your time.
No, my pleasure. Cheers, Robbie. Thank you so much.
Nice one. All right, guys, that's it for us. Hope you enjoyed our World Cup review. We'll be back, I think, either tomorrow or the day after, reviewing some more games. And for Robbie, Bielsa is the 11th Leeds manager in 4 years. Until next time, take care.